Questions? So, last time we did perturbation theory, and the idea was that real life gives us problems that are more complicated than we can solve. So, there are a list of solvable Hamiltonians, and it's not a whole lot bigger than the list of the ones that are in our book. And real life is more complicated than those, so how can we solve those? And you might hope that the same sorts of techniques that worked on the ones that are in the textbook might work in real life, but you're wrong, that they don't work. Basically, every one that does work has been solved, and they're not a whole lot like real life. So we can solve directly the differential equation on a computer, but that isn't very enlightening, right? So you get an answer, and you can check to see whether it corresponds to reality, but you kind of want to know why, how that comes about. So perturbation theory is an idea that if we take one of these solved problems that is sufficiently close to a real problem, we can look at the difference between real life and the solved problem and call that a perturbing potential, and include an adjustable parameter that when it's equal to zero, the problem we're solving is the solved problem, and when it's equal to one, it's the one that we're interested in solving. So it kind of interpolates between the solved problem and the real world. That adjustable parameter might be a real parameter, like the strength of an electric field, something that you can actually change, or the strength of a magnetic field. Or it might be just the perturbing potential might be the interaction between two electrons, which you can't turn off. There is no adjustable parameter lambda, but you can pretend as if there's one and deal with the case of non-interacting electrons in the H atom, say, something we can solve, and then turn on this perturbation and let it go between 0 and 1 and see what happens to the energy levels as we include electron-electron interactions. So the idea is that everything's going to depend continuously on that parameter lambda. So we can Taylor series expand. So the full solution to the wave function has a Taylor series expansion, and there's a kind of a detail of notation. Usually these subscripts have denoted the eigenenergy, the associated state, and that's certainly how I'm going to do it for the solved problem. But these things here are really just the coefficients of the Taylor series expansion. Okay, so for the double barred quantities, the subscript is where we are in the Taylor series expansion. For the unperturbed problem, for the solved problem, it's the usual situation where the subscripts are labeling the state. So we're going to ask the question, how does a particular state, like E2, in the unperturbed problem, how does that change as I turn on lambda? And so the plan is to find all of those expansion coefficients, and we can get a good approximation then for how the energy changes. There's kind of a mathematical note that these double barred psis aren't normalized in the usual sense. They're normalized so that to the extent that they include the unperturbed state is exactly equal to 1. It's an odd normalization, but it makes the mathematics a little bit easier. Well, with that, we showed that the first correction to the energy was just the expectation value of the potential using the unperturbed states. And the second order correction to the eigenenergy was this quantity, which has energy denominators. Differences of energy. And that's where the problem comes in for today's lecture. If we have degeneracy, then we have states that have the same energy, then we get zeros in the denominator, and kind of all bets are off. Questions? So our plan, at least the textbook's plan, is to, after we talk about degenerate perturbation theory, to go and solve atoms. And that's not going to be my plan, but I thought I would show you kind of how it works out. And we'll come back after we've done all the other ways of approximation to deal with the atom. So this is the hydrogen atom, and the lowest energy state, we put the electron in the 1s state. We can couple together the spin angular momentum of 1/2 and the orbital angular momentum of 0 to get a total angular momentum that is 1/2. And then there is spin angular momentum with the nuclei, right? The nucleus is a proton. It has spin 1/2, so we can have a singlet state where the proton and electron are spinning in opposite directions, or we can have a triplet state, three of them, of course, where the proton and the electron are spinning in the same state. So this is the exact formula for the energy level, where alpha is the fine structure constant, relativistically correct. And this separation is famous in astrophysics because hydrogen is very common in the universe, and so the transition between that triplet state and the singlet state at 1.4 gigahertz is the target of lots of radio telescopes. For excited states, all of the two n equals 2 states had the same energy, right? 2s, 2p, they had the same energy. If we just have relativity, then it turns out that first of all, if we have angular momentum, we have spin angular momentum coupled with orbital angular momentum 1 from the p state, so we can get total spin 3/2 or total spin 1/2. And if we have the 2s state, then we're just going to have total spin 1/2. And it turns out if we just have relativity, these two states have exactly the same energy, and this one is pushed up a little bit. So this is sometimes called lambda doubling. If we go to the three states, if we just have if we have everything except field theory correct, that is to say, if we're living in 1955, then these two energies are exactly the same, these two energies are exactly the same, and so it goes. There's this doubling according to the total spin angular momentum. Then in the 50s, Lamb discovered that these two states were not exactly degenerate, the way the best quantum theory of the time said they were. So explaining that Lamb shift, which requires quantum field theory, was worth several Nobel Prizes. Okay, so Lamb shift, way beyond what we could do in this class. But up to relativity, we can do pretty good. So that's, a few weeks in the future holds. But because we're interested in atoms, and because atoms are degenerate, we really have to solve the problem of degenerate perturbation theory, right? Because the four states, 2s, 2p, m equals 1, 2p, m equals 0, 2p, m equals minus 1, those four states all have the same energy, and unless something special happens, like the numerator is 0, this denominator being 0 is going to be a big problem. So degeneracy isn't super common since it requires some sort of symmetry. So in a messy problem, there isn't a lot of symmetry, so there isn't a lot of degeneracy. On the other hand, solvable problems always have a lot of symmetry, and so they always have a lot of degeneracy. So this is exactly the difference between the real world and the textbook world. Questions? So the section on degeneracy is one I don't particularly like in Griffiths because it always seems to me to be confused. It always seems to make something that is moderately simple look complicated. So the way to handle degeneracy is pretty straightforward. So I'm going to have to invent a name that I hope not going to bother you, subspace. So in the hydrogen atom, we have all of these levels, right? N goes from 1 to infinity, and L goes from 0 to N minus 1, and M goes plus minus L. There are an infinite number of states. What we want to do is just concentrate on the degenerate states. So for example, for n equals 2, this is going to be 2s and then the 3, 2p levels. Right? So this is a subset of all of the states, and that's what I mean, that's what I'm going to mean by the degenerate subspace. The set of states that are actually degenerate, necessarily a subset of all states. So for example, for n equals 3, we've got the 3s, we've got 3, 3ps, and we've got 5, 3ds. Right? So where this number comes from, 2l plus 1. Right? Everything from minus l to plus l for our possible states. So with that word degenerate subspace, 4 states for n equals 2, 9 states for n equals 3, the plan is to form the matrix that represents the operator in that subspace. That is to say, I want to make the matrix that consists of, right, so this thing here is one of these. I and J are one of the states in this degenerate subspace. Okay, so this means that for every I that's in this list, we get the same energy back. Right? And I and J, for example, might run up to the run over the total number of states in the degenerate subspace. So the plan is to calculate all of those integrals, kind of a mess, and then look at the resulting matrix and find its eigenvalues. Okay, and of course there are going to be n of them, right? Because the dimensionality, the eigenvectors have to span the space, and if the space is n-dimensional, there have to be n of them. Let me denote these states with Greek letters, though. Okay, so these guys still have exactly the same energy as the other guys, right? Because we started with the alphas are just linear combination of the I's, so of course they're going to satisfy the same Hamiltonian. But they're going to have the nice property, usually, not always, but usually, they're going to have the nice property that if I choose different states, if I choose if I choose the eigenvectors as the basis for this degenerate subspace, then the matrix that represents V is going to be diagonal. That is to say, the off-diagonal elements are going to be zero. And that's great. That solves the problem, because if we use these states instead of these states, then this quantity is going to be zero anytime that quantity is going to be zero. Okay, so that's the must-have. So somehow or other, we have to find states where that's equal to zero if we're talking about this, if we're talking about different states. That's the only way we're going to solve the degeneracy problem. And we've usually, not always, usually have done it automatically by finding the eigenvectors and values. Under these circumstances, then the zero order correction, right, if I do this process, I'm just going to get the corresponding eigenvalues. So the first order correction is just going to be the eigenvalues of that operator. Okay. So, saying it again, in order to avoid zeros in the denominator, I got to have zeros in the numerator. I have to have states that don't connect through the potential. And I can usually automatically achieve that by finding the eigenvectors of the matrix that represents the perturbation in the degenerate subspace. So lots of verbiage. I hope the meaning of all of those words are clear. Then, the first order correction is just the eigenvalues that we found from that matrix. If we want to go on and calculate the second order perturbation, it's always a mess because it has an infinite sum. So it's no messier than it was before, and it has the advantage that it's not infinite, right? So since these things are going to be zero if we're in the degenerate subspace, the only terms that are going to be in the sum are ones that are outside of the degenerate subspace, which necessarily means that this term isn't zero in the denominator, but it does mean that we've got an infinite number of states to sum over, which is no better or worse than what it would be otherwise. Okay, but what's the proof? Let's take a look at the proof that those things have to be zero if we're using an eigenvector. So I think it's useful to switch over to the notation. Since these things are usually going to be finite dimensional vector spaces, it's usually convenient to think about them as being vectors. So here is the matrix, this matrix that we get from V, and here is the one of these eigenvalues that we got from from solving the eigenvalue. What I want to do, and of course this thing is equal to E alpha, whatever that eigenvalue was, times the corresponding vector. So the plan is going to be to take another one of these eigenvectors and Hermitian conjugate it, right? So we need to Hermitian conjugate it to get the star, which you know is part of the dot product, and it needs to be horizontal, so we need to transpose it so that it looks like that, so we can do normal matrix multiplication. Now, a factoid that I'm sure has cropped up, maybe you remember it before, and that is that the transpose of the product is the product of the transpose written in reverse order. So I can write this piece of it as the V matrix times the beta matrix transposed. And of course, the alpha is going to go along for the ride. But now I know that that's equal to E beta like that. E beta is just a number. So what I'm going to get out of this is going to be E beta and then the dot product of those two vectors. Okay, and if I do it the other way up here, I'm going to get E alpha times that same thing. Okay, and so the difference has to be if we bring everything to the other side of the equation, what we're going to have is that E alpha minus E beta, and then let me just use the dot hand alpha dot beta. This has to be zero. So if these are distinct eigenvalues, then this quantity has to be zero. So the only circumstance we have to worry about this quantity not being zero is when we find, when we solve the matrix problem of the eigenvalues of the matrix that represents the perturbation in the degenerate subspace, when that doesn't have distinct eigenvalues. And that should be rare, right? Because there's no particular reason for eigenvalues to be the same, unless there's symmetry. So, and again, those are exactly the cases that we often have, where we have lots of symmetry. So if we have symmetry, still, pretty commonly, this quantity is going to be zero. And let's take a look at that. So let's say I have an operator, let me call it O, well, let me call it Q. O's look a lot like zeros. So let me say I have an operator Q, which commutes with a Hamiltonian, and it commutes with the perturbation. And let me give you an example. So if we're talking about the Stark effect, then the perturbation is going to be the strength of the electric field times Z. So in this case, V would be Z. And the angular momentum in the Z direction, that commutes with a Hamiltonian. Right, the Hamiltonian is spherically symmetric. It commutes with all of the L's, including L squared. And it commutes with Z, right? The only thing that wouldn't commute with this would be X or Y, right? Z commutes with LZ. Okay, so not uncommonly, we can find an operator which commutes with the Hamiltonian and commutes with the perturbation. And under those circumstances, we can also show that these things are going to be zero. So let's take a look at how that works. Well, I guess I have to give a little bit of proviso. It's going to work the same way as it worked over there. We're going to get zero if the alpha and beta have different eigenvalues of the Q operator. Okay, so what we have is H, say the alpha is equal to E alpha alpha, and now I'm going to have my Q alpha, my Q operator is also going to be an eigenfunction of the Q. Okay, and again, in our example, this would be M, right? The states that have angular momentum in the Z direction, the states that you typically have been using for the hydrogen atom have a definite amount of angular momentum in the Z direction, which you called M. Okay, so then we can take a look at that integral. It's definitely zero because Q and V commute. And you can see how this thing's going to work out, right? So when Q operates on this, we're going to get Q sub alpha. And if we bring Q onto this side, we're going to get Q beta. So we're going to end up then with Q alpha minus Q beta times this matrix element that we hope is zero. So if we have different values of Q, then we're going to be guaranteed that this guy is equal to zero. Okay, so I don't know, maybe I'm not doing any better than the book. The upshot is that if we have degenerate states, the plan is to make the matrix that is made up of states in that degenerate subspace, find the eigenvectors and values of that matrix, and then use those eigenvectors as the states. Change the basis from whatever you started with to the basis that consists of alpha and beta. In that basis, the first order correction to the eigenenergies, double bar E1, is going to be the eigenvalues, and we're guaranteed to have, we're mostly guaranteed to have the states that would cause problems, that is to say, connections between states in the degenerate subspace through V. It's a complicated way of saying that that term isn't zero, those sort of states. Okay. Yes.
On the homework for, you just said star n equals 4, star energies. What is the end goal? Is that the spectrum of energies, or is it just finding the eigenvalues and eigenvectors and like this? Like, I just was kind of confused what the goal was.
Yep. So that's the plan. So the plan is very similar to the homework, to go over some Stark states. So again, we're thinking about putting an electric field on a hydrogen atom. The states are going to change a little bit. The perturbation is going to be the charge on an electron, the strength of the electric field, and Z. And that's because the potential is going to be minus E naught Z, and the charge of a particle is minus E. So the perturbation is that, and we might as well just call this Z. Save ourselves some work. So what we want to do then is we want to calculate all of those matrix elements in the degenerate subspace. So I think that was your question, basically. What do I mean when I say N equals 3? So we're talking about the hydrogen atom. And so we have n equals 1, n equals 2, n equals 3, n equals 4. The ground state, 1s, is not degenerate. N equals 2 has a total of 4 degenerate states, right? There are really 3 there. N equals 3 there are 9 degenerate states. N equals 4, there are 25 degenerate states. Okay, so when I say deal with N equals 3, I mean deal with that set of states. So we're going to have 9 basis states. We're going to have 9 by 9 matrices. We're going to find eigenvalues and eigenvectors of 9 by 9 matrices, so we're not going to do it by hand, right? We're going to do it with computer. So the kind of the first problem has to do with the names of things. So in mathematics, we really like it if our indices for our matrices go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But our indices are going to go LM, right? So for these set of states, we're going to have 0, 0, 1 minus 1, 1, 0, 1 plus 1, right? Where these are the LM states. And there's nothing wrong with it. It's just confusing, right? So the plan, of course, is we're just going to call this 1 and 2 and 3 and 4. But in order to calculate stuff, we really need to be able to get the L and the M value from, say, the number 3. Somehow or other, I have to say, okay, if I'm talking about 3, I'm talking about an L equals 1 state, a P state, that has M equals 0. So how can we do this decoding so that we can deal with indices that run 1, 2, 3, but we can somehow get out the L and M that correspond to it, right? So it's just a naming problem. So the solution I came up with, at least, is the one that's in your handout. So do you see, I don't know, kind of three lines down there? It says LM, so that's the name of something, equals a bunch of set notation. Starts out 00, 11, 10, etc. So LM is a set of sets, and the elements of that outer set are pairs of L and M. So 0, 0 corresponds to L equals 0, M equals 0. The next one corresponds to L equals 1 and M equals 1. Next one corresponds to L equals 1, M equals 0. So I can extract the L, M, and M that I need to do calculations just from the index of this set of sets. Okay, so the notation that Mathematica, so in computer languages, typically we might have, you know, something like that, an array of numbers, like in Fortran last semester. So in Mathematica, they have kind of a different notation. One square bracket has been used up to be functions, so we can't use that. And curly brackets are used for grouping, so we can't use that. So Mathematica's solution is to use doubled square brackets. So for example, doubled square L and M, doubled square bracket 3 is the third element in that set, which is 1, 0. Okay, so we're now not talking about physics, we're talking about how to make Mathematica do physics for us. The problem is that any mathematician wants the indices of their matrices to go 1, 2, 3, but we need to get the L and M component out of that in order to do calculations. Okay, so I can get the L component by taking the first element, and that's a function, so there's one square bracket, in the array that's going to give me the L value. And the last element in this thing, that's going to give me the M value. Okay, so this is just a way of getting the L and M values out. Okay, so what are the wave functions that I need to integrate, right? So I need to do things that are, I want to take a wave function that has some L, M, and N, and it's of course a function of R theta and phi, and I want to complex conjugate that, stick a Z in here. I'm going to choose a different element in the degenerate set. So in general, L prime doesn't equal M prime, but N is always going to equal 2, I think, in this particular problem. 3, N equals 3. And then I want to integrate this. What? What are the, so this is the exam problem. Tell me exactly the range of integration and what I need to do. So Kyle's going to give me one integral.
Is it theta to, from 0 to 2 pi? Is it theta to pi?
Or yeah. 0 to pi? Yeah, you can either change that or not. So one thing is theta going from 0 to pi. Is there anything that goes with that d theta? We need a sine theta. Next.
R is going from 0 to infinity. It's R squared dr.
And phi from negative pi to pi?
Yeah, or 0 to 2 pi.
And those are equivalent because in here you have negative pi to pi, but 0 to 2 pi is the same thing.
Should be. So sometimes anti-symmetry helps for things, and so I can't remember if I tried 0 to 2 pi and then switched to minus pi, but mathematically they should be exactly the same. Can you see that that's exactly what I wrote there? So you can see the r squared sine theta, you see the integrals. Z is, of course, equal to r cosine theta, and that's in the next set. So first of all, what is in this first grouping? Well, I wanted to make sure I was on the right page at all, right? So these wave functions better be normalized. So I said, okay, I've got 9 wave functions. Let me do 81 integrals of all possible combinations of function on one side, function on the other. Right? I wouldn't want to do that myself, but Mathematica can do that sort of stuff. So incidentally, if you look up top, you see the definition of the function. So again, that was an old exam question. So it depends on N and L and M and R. And I guess I didn't bother to write the sine theta cosine stuff in there because I'm always going to use the names theta and phi for those variables.
What is pokehammer?
Ah, the pokehammer symbol. So it's a really handy thing, and it's also called the shifted factorial. So a normal factorial is that, right? You start at 1 and you work your way up. Alpha sub 3, I start at alpha. Yeah, I was worried that it might be going down as opposed to up, but it goes up. So the Pockhammer symbol, alpha sub 3, is 3 things in a row starting with alpha, add an integer every time. So in particular, this means 1 sub n is equal to n factorial, right? Because it's n things in a row starting at 1 and adding 1 every time. So the Pockhammer symbol is a generalization of the factorial function. And the book writes it in terms of factorials, I think. But I know that lots of things are written better in terms of Pockhammer. The rest of the world hasn't caught on to this fact that has been made clear to me. Okay, so it's kind of a mess, right? I mean, who remembers their Laguerre polynomials? Not me, but Mathematica does. So once I've got those guys, I can kind of forget them. I can just use them. So all I have to do is to extract from my IJK the L and the M value. N is always going to equal 3. So I hope you can see where I've extracted them, right? That's first of LM of bracket, bracket I. And I should be doing good work. Just think how easier the exam would have been if you just did it all in Mathematica. Okay, so this is all online. So I'm going to just copy and paste these things in. And what I should be able to do then. So it's table, because I want a matrix, right? I'm going to have I and J both going from 1 to 9. So I make a table of tables, which is the same as a matrix. It doesn't look much like a matrix until I ask for matrix form of it. Oh, I guess I'm doing N equals 4 here. I guess in the handout I did N equals 3, huh? Okay. Just makes it even more exciting, right? So now I've got, what, 81 states? I don't know. Some huge number of states. Oh, I've got 16 by 16. So it's a 256 entries in a matrix. And wow, right? So it's almost everywhere 0 except on the diagonals, right? That means that everything's normalized. So it's looking good. Okay, so now the real money comes by putting the z in there, right? I want the expectation of z, which is r cosine theta. And so Mathematica is going to go do 256 integrals that have z in there. Incidentally, if we were smart, I mean, it's repetitive, right? So the matrix is symmetric. I could only do the upper triangle of it and copy it, but it only takes Mathematica a few seconds to do it. So there are lots of zeros in here. And I won't do the matrix form because I don't think it'll fit on that page, but here it is in this text file, all of those various integrals, most of which are zero. So what I really want then is to find the eigenvectors and eigenvalues. So did I hit return or something? Oh, I must, I don't know. What happened? I don't think Mathematica's in a happy place. I think I must have copied and pasted that in. Okay. So now I'm going to do the eigensystem of that. Hopefully, you might remember that percentage sign refers to the last thing. So here are the list of eigenfunctions and eigenvalues for this problem. So the first thing you should note is that these things are not, I have not broken the degeneracy, right? I have 2 minus 12s. I've got 3 minus 6s. I've got 4 zeros. And the proof that we had, that these things didn't, that this new basis didn't connect to itself through the perturbation, that is to say that I could use second order perturbation, that required that I have non-degenerate eigenvectors. So it's not looking good. I mean, you might worry that I'm going to have some terms that have zero in the denominator and not zero other places. So I should maybe comment while I'm at it, I don't really actually intend to do second order perturbation theory, but if the second order term is infinite, the first order term is nonsense. So even though my plan is to quit at first order perturbation, I have to be sure that the next order term is an infinite. So I better make sure, somehow I have to convince myself that all of these things are zero, even if the eigen energies are the same, right? There are 4 of them there with zero. Well, let's take a look at the eigenvectors, and maybe that'll give us some clues about what's going on. And maybe I should switch to what you actually have hard copy of, because this is the easier case. It fits on 2 pieces of paper. Yeah, so let's bring back the blackboard. So the handout here was n equals 2, right?
N equals 3.
It was n equals 3? Okay, so I did n equals 4 here. So I had n equals 3, so I had 3s, 3p, and 3d. And the way these states were ordered were 0, 0, 1, 1, 1, 0, 1 minus 1, and then 2, 2, 2 minus 2. Okay, so we have, well, let's just go through them one at a time. So what Mathematica is telling us on this first line, those are the eigenvalues. So the eigenvalues are minus 9, 9, minus 9 halves, minus 9 halves, 9 halves, 9 halves, 0, 0, 0. The eigenvectors are the things that are below it in the same order. So the first eigenvector has square root of 2 here. They're not normalized. Has a square root of 3 here. And it's got a 1 there. So what's special about that guy? Well, what's special about this guy is it's made up only of states that have m equals 0. So this guy is an eigenfunction of Lz with eigenvalue m equals 0. And let's also put the eigenenergy here, right? Because this is minus 9. How about the next state? Well, the only difference is this sign, right? So this is also a state that has m equals 0. And if we go to the very last one, that one also has m equals 0. You buying all of this? Not. Catherine, do you believe this? You guess yes. If you have to bet your life on it, are you sure about it? Was that a no, Kyle? I couldn't see that.
The last one was m equals
0? Yeah, I think the last one is m equals 0 too. Oh, I guess it's the second to the last one. My finger was covering one up. You said you were sure. You saw my big fat finger covering it up. Okay, does everyone agree that the second one to the bottom has m equals 0? And that one has 0 for its eigenenergy, right? Okay, so how about the third one from the top? What's special about it? Yeah. So this was three zeros and a one, and then one from the end, there was a one. So all of those have m equals minus one. And this particular one, it's the third state, so it has energy minus 9 halves. And if you look at the one that's kind of in the middle, so it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 from the top. It must be 5 from the bottom, then 2. Do you agree that that one's the same, except it has a sign difference, right? So that's also an m equals minus 1. And since it's the fifth one, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, it has an eigenvalue that's 9 halves. Okay. Okay, so that was the third. How about the fourth from the top? That's m equals 1, right? And fourth, 1, 2, 3, 4, that's a minus 9 halves. And if we look down 2 from it, there's one that's the same except for a sign. That's a plus 9 halves. So we ought to have some m equals 2 here, right? Where's the m equals 2? Ah, so third from the bottom, that's an m equals minus 2, right? Because the only thing that's non-zero is, in fact, the m equals minus 2. And similarly, the very bottom one is an m equals 2. So both of those are... I'm not sure I'm happy with what I just said. So the bottom one is an m equals 2. Oh, and the third one from the bottom is an m equals minus 2. I'm not sure if I said that or not. But those are both zeros, right? Okay, so let's kind of display graphically what's going on. So here we have m values from minus 2, minus 1, 0, 1, and 2. For m equals 0, we've got states that are 9, 0, and minus 9. For m equals 1, we have plus minus 9 halves. So that's kind of the array of energy levels. Okay. And what I know for sure is that these two guys, for example, are not connected through V. That is to say, if I take alpha V alpha, alpha V beta with these two states, I have to get zero. And I have to get zero because they have different eigenvalues. Right? This one has an eigenvalue of plus 9 halves, this one has a value of minus 9 halves. So what I have to worry about is, do these guys satisfy that this equals zero? They have the same eigenvalue. So the proof that I wrote down before doesn't say that these guys are going to be zero, because they have the same eigenenergy. They're still degenerate. Why are they zero? So this is the Q that I was talking about before. So remember I said if I had another operator which commuted with both the Hamiltonian and the perturbation, and that was true of LZ, it commutes with a hydrogen atom and it commutes with Z. If it had different eigenvalues, then this integral had to be zero. So these guys have different M values, and so this quantity has to be zero for it. So this all happened automatically, so it looked like I didn't have to do work to achieve that. But in general, that won't be the case. You will do your eigenvalue problem and you'll find things that have the same eigenenergy for this matrix problem. But they won't necessarily, this thing won't necessarily be zero unless you make these things be eigenvalues of this third operator. Okay, so I repeat, in this particular problem, we didn't seem to have to do any work. They came out orthogonal automatically, or unconnected, I would say, through V. But in general, you're going to have to do some work if the matrix has the same eigenvalues, if it is itself degenerate. And what the book suggests, and which often works, is to find an operator that commutes with the Hamiltonian and the perturbation, and then use states that have definite values of that operator's eigenvalues, like M. Okay, so to say it differently, it's exactly the same problem if I put the electric field in the x direction as opposed to the z direction. Right? Space doesn't care which way the electric field is going. It's going to have exactly the same energy levels, but it will not automatically be the case that the eigenenergies, the vectors I get out, satisfy this condition. I'll have to do that by hand. Okay, so the short story is that for degenerate states, what you do is you form the matrix in the subspace of degenerate states, form the matrix of the perturbation, find the eigenvectors and values. If those eigenvectors and values are distinct, you're home free. And then the first order correction is those eigenenergies. If they're not distinct, then you're going to have to do some more work to somehow convince yourself that this is the case, because that's the condition we need for second order perturbation to be correct. And I can think of lots of cases where things work out easily and lots of cases where they don't. But I guess I would say, typically, you don't have to do a whole lot in that second step. Usually just finding the eigenvalues of the matrix is enough, but not always. Okay. So the plan is to postpone the rest of this chapter, go on to the next chapter, which is the next approximation method, which is called Rayleigh-Ritz, or the variational.